How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
Welcome to Climate One, a conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. To understand any of them, you have to understand them all. I'm Greg Dalton. Today we're discussing the upcoming elections. Rising gas prices have triggered a political firestorm around a range of energy issues, from subsidies for fossil and clean fuels to the Keystone XL pipeline, speculative trading, and tapping the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. President Obama has vilified big oil while also calling for more domestic oil production. Climate and cap and trade have become toxic words that rarely cross the lips of politicians in either party. For the next hour, we'll discuss energy policy and politics with our live audience at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. And joining us, we're delighted to welcome three experts. Donnie Fowler is a Democratic clean tech strategist. Lauren Kay is president of the California Foundation for Commerce and Education, a think tank affiliated with the California Chamber of Commerce. And Dave Metz is a pollster with FM3, a Democratic polling shop that does a lot of work with a Republican polling firm. Please welcome them to Climate One. So, Dave, let's begin with you. We're in an election cycle. How does energy rank right now in terms of the political debate and the polling that you're seeing in there nationally? And then we'll get into some California issues.
Well, I think it's important to think about public opinion on energy in two dimensions. The first dimension is what types of energy policies most Americans support. And there we see actually a lot of unanimity on some of the big picture questions. Most Americans, regardless of geography, political party, gender, age, are most supportive of expanding use of renewable energy, solar and wind power in particular. And they are much less supportive of continued use of fossil fuels, coal and oil, most notably, with natural gas an exception to that has relatively high levels of support. But once we get past those patterns, the second and more important question is how much do those issues matter when voters are making their decisions about how they're going to cast their ballots? And there the results are somewhat more mixed. In certain parts of the country, in certain races, it's likely to be a very important issue. But there are other places, particularly in this economy, where there may be other issues that get more attention and are a little bit more on voters' minds. And I think a lot of these campaigns are going to be about trying to find ways to frame the energy issue and make it drive votes in ways that will benefit either party.
And we'll get into some of the language around that and some of the specifics. Lauren Kay, would you agree with that, that Americans are generally favorable toward gas and renewables, not so much coal? We don't have much coal here in California. Would you agree with what Dave Metz said?
Oh, sure. Just asking a question straight up about what sort of energy you prefer, most Americans, most Californians will say exactly what Dave did. The key issue, though, is what happens when it comes down to choices? What happens when you say that choosing a certain kind of energy will make it more expensive, will raise the cost of your energy bills? Then that's when you get a real discussion. That's when you really get to understand the importance of these policy choices. And the best example of that is gasoline prices now. Gasoline prices are going up. They're not at record highs, but they're going up. But people are really noticing. They're telling pollsters it's a big deal, and the politicians are scrambling on it.
Donnie Fowler, do voters might say, it's one thing to tell a pollster something, it's another thing to vote that way. Do people actually vote based on their beliefs in energy? Does energy matter when people go in the ballot box, or is it health care, economics, taxes, social issues?
Well, to the degree that energy is tied to economics, it does affect and influence the vote. The other way to think about energy as an issue is really what it represents as a value. And so for Democrats, liberals, energy, alternative energy, and the environment represent a certain value that they hold, and they want their candidates to share that value. For conservatives, there's another set of values that when you talk about energy, you know, the idea of more oil production at home, it's not because they're for more oil production per se, it's that it represents a set of values to conservative voters. And so energy matters within a certain set of value frames for voters more than it probably matters as an issue that they think specifically about when they're in that voting booth.
Lauren Kay, would you agree with that? That Republicans value energy differently, or that there's this sort of value sets and energy is one thing in there?
Well, that's an interesting point that Donnie made. I think that when Republicans and conservatives think about energy, they think about it in terms of its relationship to the economy, that it's an indivisible part of the economy, and they also think about it in terms of security. That you know, when you hear politicians talking about producing energy at home, reducing the influence of foreign oil, I mean, that may not make any sense economically, but it makes a lot of sense politically, and that's an important thing for Americans generally, but conservatives and Republicans in particular.
Does anyone ever get voted in or out of office because of their voting record on energy?
Well, it probably didn't help Jimmy Carter back in 1980.
The cardigan sweater.
I don't know, Dave.
It's hard to say whether people get voted in or out of office solely on that issue, but I think there is ample evidence that politicians think that associating themselves with clean energy is going to help them politically. If you want to meet political candidates or elected officials, you should open up a solar manufacturing shop, because there will be press conferences and front of your office all day long. And there's a reason for that. It's because voters across party lines, as Lauren and I have said, support these policies.
Although I talked with a guy from Solyndra last night who said the last thing you want to do is have a politician come to your factory, because then it becomes politicized. He wishes President Obama never went to Solyndra because, you know, they could have flown under the radar, right? So that's a double-edged...
Perhaps, but Solyndra is a little bit of an exceptional case, and when we talk about energy this year, that's inevitably going to get raised. And just one thing I'd note about that, we've done a lot of research around public attitudes towards Solyndra, and what we found is that, first of all, in the big picture, when we asked voters nationally in a poll about a month ago whether they thought Solyndra was evidence that public investment in renewable energy wasn't worth it, that the industry didn't have merit, that it wasn't capable of sustaining itself without a public subsidy, or, on the other hand, whether they thought the failure of Solyndra was an isolated instance where one company's business plan wasn't successful, but the industry as a whole was healthy and worthy of public support. By a 2-to-1 margin, they chose the latter position. And what we're really seeing is that the discontent that the public has about Solyndra is not about public investment in renewable energy per se. It is about spending massive amounts of public money in an attempt to stimulate a business and create jobs in a way that failed. It's part of a broader narrative about the economy and the role of public spending in stimulating more job creation. It is not about the fundamental viability of renewable energy.
The government should be doing this, period. This is something for markets and companies to do, not government.
Or government does it badly when it tries to do it.
So Solyndra is not an indictment on the solar industry. If you ask analysts, Bloomberg and others, professional financial analysts, the solar industry is expected to more than double in the next 5 years in the United States. So Solyndra
You mean installation, not necessarily manufacturing.
Yeah, there will be more than twice as much solar in the United States, solar energy in the United States in the next 5 years. Some people say 3 or 4 times as much. Those are the financial analysts. That tells you really the health of the solar industry. Solyndra is in fact a political story. And it's a political story driven by two interests. The first interest are the people who don't want competition in the market. That's the natural gas and the coal folks. They don't want to have to compete for that consumer dollar or for that utilities plant.
So they're rooting for solar to fail.
They want to find ways to destroy solar in the marketplace, reduce competition. The other people who don't really care about the market for energy are some, not all, Republican campaign operatives who see an opportunity with Solyndra to paint President Obama as corrupt somehow, despite the fact that Solyndra's CEO, when it went bankrupt, was a Republican. But the idea of these Republican campaign operatives is this is a way we can say that President Obama is corrupt. And this is a way we can say that President Obama doesn't know what he's doing when he spends all this money. So, again, Solyndra is a political story, not really an accurate tale about what's happening in the solar industry in the United States.
Lauren Kay, how do you see Solyndra?
No, but
I agree in part, but I think that, you know, Donnie might be whistling past the graveyard a little bit here. because what Solyndra represents, as Dave said, in large part, is the ineptitude of government in choosing
winners and losers. Not, losers.
Well, yeah. and individual companies too.
Yeah.
And that goes to a fundamental narrative that is widely shared in the American electorate, that government does a horrible job spending money, and it's my money. You know, I just paid my taxes, and they're wasting it all. And when there's a bankruptcy of Solyndra, when you see all these tales of subsidies and handouts and corporate welfare, whatever you want to call it, that creates an atmosphere that is really poisonous for this industry. No matter what happens to President Obama or Mitt Romney in 2012, this issue will remain, and it's something that people who receive subsidies have to contend with.
And you see pretty clearly President Obama's playing this subsidy game too, because he's saying the oil, natural gas, and the coal companies don't need subsidies anymore. So you do have this argument about who's feeding at the public trough, and the Republicans say, oh, it's those green, environmental, tree-hugging solar and wind people, and the Democrats are saying, oh, it's the dirty energy companies. Now, the one part that really doesn't work here is that conservatives who largely are backing the dirty energy industry claim they want a free market, but you don't hear many of them say, take away the oil subsidies, take away the coal subsidies, take away the natural gas subsidies. They're being very selective in their free market ideology.
Is that true, Lauren Kay? I mean, there's subsidies on both sides. You know, if you're getting something, you call it an incentive or have some other word for it. If somebody else gets it, it's a subsidy, right? It's a bad thing. If you're getting it, it's
an investment.
It's a support. it's investment. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think it would. I don't want to torture your audience by getting into the arcane details of who gets what and how much subsidies. I think the key difference, though, is that whatever the subsidies are that are provided to coal and oil, they're not critical to the survival of those industries. They might make them more profitable. They might drive investment one place or another.
So then taking away shouldn't matter.
I'm not here to defend them. I'm just telling you the difference. But for the wind and solar industry, those subsidies are the difference between mm-hmm. life and death. I mean, you see what's happened to First Solar in Germany. The Germans are, along with a lot of the Europeans, are removing the subsidies from solar, and the industry is in desperate shape when you add some of the other factors they're facing. So the difference between the carbon-based energy and the solar-based energy in subsidies is that, one, it's nice to have, the other, it's critical.
And one way to create a level playing field would be to internalize the costs, right? So there's a lot of externalities, things that the atmosphere is used as a free sewer, a free dump for a lot of fossil fuels, and if things were levelized, then wouldn't that be a different situation? I mean, real free market people and economists would want that, right? To internalize the externalities and get away with the subsidies and have real competition. That makes sense?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Of course, we've been doing that for decades for air pollution and water pollution. California has some of the most stringent air pollution laws in the world. And I'd say that to a large extent, air pollution and water pollution has been internalized in California. And you're finding industries are, those that chosen to remain here are doing okay.
I think it's
a bit of a red herring to suggest that, you know, the atmosphere is a sewer. The air quality in California is cleaner than it's ever been since the industrial age. The water quality in California is cleaner than it's ever been in the industrial age. And so the fact is that because of progressive laws and regulations, especially in California, there have been, and as you put it, and internalization of the environmental costs of pollution.
Dave, that you wanted to jump in here?
No, not on that specific point. I did have a thought earlier on the issue of subsidies for industries. I mean, we talk about how the industries that are built on fossil fuels are essential today. Well, the government built an interstate highway system in the 1950s, which is a major subsidy to one industry. Talk about picking winners and losers. Now, that may have been an industry that was destined to win anyway, but we now have that system in place, and it's very hard to move away from it. If we want major change in the infrastructure we use to provide ourselves with energy or to serve any of the other vital needs that the country has, at some point there is a break where you need to make a new investment. And so I think, you know, in that framework, to sort of start our thinking now and say that our reliance on fossil fuels is sort of here and always been here ignores some of the history that led up to that.
But there weren't a lot of competing technologies for interstate highways, right?
The rail system. Government-subsidized, created during the Civil War. The airlines were just growing to being fully commercial and available to the public in the 50s. So, yeah, there were competing transportation systems
and
in the 50s.
And we went with highways, and here we are.
Here we are.
We're talking about politics and energy here at the Climate One, the Commonwealth Club. Our guests are Donnie Fowler, a Democratic clean tech strategist, Lauren Kay from a think tank affiliated with the California Chamber of Commerce, and Dave Metz, a pollster. I'm Greg Dalton. Let's talk a little bit about the Keystone Pipeline. That's been a very much of a political issue these days nationally. It doesn't really touch California, but it does say a lot about energy in this political year. And so what some people say that we shouldn't invest in that because it's 40 years of dirty infrastructure. The AFL-CIO is for it. They want the jobs. They think it's a good investment project. Donnie Fowler, what does Keystone tell us about the energy debate in this political year?
It is, like a lot of issues, it also represents a value statement. That oil from Canada, a lot of which will move through the Keystone Pipeline, is going to go to market some way, whether it goes off of eastern Canada, western Canada, or through the United States. It's going to find its way into the market. So stopping the Keystone Pipeline is not stopping the flow of Canadian oil.
Although a lot of opponents kind of might make that claim.
Well, they think
it will
make it more expensive. So the Keystone Pipeline, in reality, is a statement about values. Environmental community in the United States in particular wants to make a statement. If you are against the Keystone Pipeline, you're an environmentalist. You represent clean energy, alternative energy, or at least the end stopping dirty energy. And so if you're against the Keystone Pipeline, that's your values. If you're for the Keystone Pipeline, you have another set of values. And so the politics of it sets up that way. The reality of it is that at the end of the day, that oil is going to find its way to market.
So it's not going to make a difference either way. Dave Metz?
It'll be a moral victory if the Keystone
They're very
Pipeline
excited
stopped.
About it. The environmentalists think they're having some influence. Hey, we got Obama to hedge on it. They're all excited, but it may not make a difference. Dave Metz?
Well, I tend to see this issue entirely through the lens of politics. I mean, the fact of the matter is there are two large groups which are major constituencies for the Democratic Party, people who consider themselves strong environmentalists and people who are supporters of labor unions. And what we find is that what most of the American public wants, 76% of them, believe that we can craft policies that are going to give us a healthy environment and a strong economy at the same time. Jobs with clean air, clean water, and a healthy environment. And what a project like this does when it's framed the way it's been framed is force a choice and say we have to pick one or the other. We have to pick jobs or a clean environment. And if we're choosing to protect the environment, that means we're inherently going to lose jobs. That's the way it's been framed politically, and understandably, for a president in an election year, that's a very tough position for him to be in. And
that's why he tried to put it off until after the election.
Yeah, it's politically very well done. But the question really is, are the jobs that would be created by this project irreplaceable? Is this the only way those kinds of jobs can be generated? Would the delay to complete the environmental review be fatal to the prospect of having those jobs in a way that would also allow for environmental protection? And that's where I think you see election year politics play into it.
Lauren Kay, any thoughts on Keystone, even though it doesn't really touch California, the oil wouldn't come into California?
Right. Well, President Obama was against the Keystone Pipeline before he was for it. Had the State Department announce that it was going to be postponed, the entire pipeline, and then a few weeks later he announced that, this other part of the pipeline is going to be built. So it's, as Dave said, it is entirely a political issue. It's entirely about trying to paddle on the left to please some of the San Francisco environmentalists and paddle on the right to please some of the Midwest labor unions. And I think the president has done about as well as he could hope to do if his goal was to upset the least amount of his base.
Or both at the same time.
At the same time. And of the first phase of Keystone before the XL, the extension, went in a couple years ago with hardly a peep. No, I never heard of it. Did anyone heard of Keystone before the XL? Very few people. It went into Cushing, right, from Canada into Cushing. No, all of a sudden, I think the companies were certainly caught by surprise at what that became sort of this national lightning rod. Donnie Fowler, is it possible to build Keystone in an environmentally responsible way? And, you know, this false choice of...
You picked the wrong panelist to determine the environmental impact of the Keystone Pipeline. I don't know how you build it, or if you can. You may be able to.
Let's talk about another lightning rod issue, which has been cap and trade, which is something that we were sitting here 3 years ago. Everyone would be talking about cap and trade. It was a market-based mechanism. Dave Metz, I know you've done some polling on market-based mechanism versus regulatory mechanisms. Tell us how Americans look at market solutions or government regulatory solutions.
Well, it's important to keep in mind that cap and trade as a framework for dealing with carbon pollution is a Republican idea. It's a conservative principle that drives it. Much like the health care reform that the president passed, which was based on market incentives and was originally presented as a Republican alternative to President Clinton's plan. There was a time when invoking market mechanisms was enough to get broad support from the center and right of the American public. But things have shifted. And even that kind of framework for a segment of the Republican Party is not an acceptable alternative now, which means that the Republican support you might have seen a decade ago or two decades ago for this kind of policy, when something similar was used to address acid rain, has receded. And the problem from the perspective of advocates of the policy is it's a very difficult policy to explain. When we sit down in focus groups,
it's a process, right?
It's a process.
You don't sell process.
Right.
That's what. Right.
Right. I mean, the metaphor we always use to talk about this is the brownie box. If you all think about shopping for brownies and you're pushing your cart down the aisle and there's a wall of brownie boxes in front of you, the brownie marketing gurus know that what will get you to buy it is giving you a picture of a perfectly soft-baked, delectable brownie, in large image right there on the front of the box. That's what you want. Now, if you buy the box, that's not what you get. You get a bag of powder inside, and you have to turn the box around, and you see a list of very small, detailed instructions on the back that tell you how to turn the powder into the brownie. Well, what we want out of cap and trade is cleaner air. We want good, clean energy jobs. We want to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. These things are the brownie that we want. But in selling the policy, we find ourselves too often turning the brownie box around and reading the recipe, and talking about how the process, because it's novel, because it's market-based, because it's equitable, because it's efficient, is the right way to go about getting it. And for the public, all of that at best confuses them and at worst alienates them. And so the messaging that's used to sell that process, I think, is misplaced. What we really need to be doing is talking about the ends rather than the means. And that's what's bogged down support for cap and trade over the years.
So it should have been called something else. There should have been another name for cap and trade. Lauren Kay, you have your thoughts on cap and trade?
Sorry, I was thinking about brownies.
Yeah, right. What kind of brownies? Yeah. The Republican
issue with cap and trade isn't about cap and trade per se, because Greg, you're right. Cap and trade is a market mechanism. Republicans like market mechanisms. When President Bush, 41, signed the Clean Air Act, there was a market mechanism in there for sulfur dioxide. Very successful. Market mechanisms have been used elsewhere for just these reasons. It's not the market mechanism, and it's misleading to suggest that all of a sudden Republicans are opposed to a market mechanism. What they're opposed to is the notion that, they're opposed to a lot of things having to do with climate change, and most of them have to do with the fact that people care about the economy more these days than they do about climate change. But
it has to do with, you know, should the United States, or here we can talk about California, should the U.S. or California be going its own way on climate change regulation without the rest of the world joining in? Is the amount of reduction commensurate with the benefit that we'd receive and the effect on the economy? These are the sorts of things that are concerning Republicans and voters to the extent they think about it. It's not the mechanism itself. So to say that all of a sudden Republicans are flip-flopping on market-based mechanisms isn't true. What they're having second thoughts about is, you know, getting into this issue alone and at this time.
Well, the Waxman-Markey bill, which federally, basically, when you talk about cap and trade, is either the Waxman-Markey bill or the Warner-Lieberman bill, was what, how many hundreds of pages, went through a lot of committee process. So Republicans had a lot of chances to improve a imperfect mechanism. If it was fundamentally the right direction, but this was, you know, turn this nut or change this, there was lots of opportunity to do that in the legislative process. In fact, one of the critiques of Waxman-Markey was it was so bloated, there was something in there for everybody, that it kind of amounted to legislative mush. I mean, is that fair, Lauren, that you know, they could have fixed what they wanted to fix in it?
Legislative mush. I like that. Well, at the time, they couldn't have fixed it because they were the minority in the House, and the majority of the House determines what the House does. And so I think it's unlikely that...
But there are lots of handouts to Coles.
That would have happened. Well, I'm sure that's true. But it was probably not... They were probably not handed out to Republicans in the House, because you don't need Republican votes to pass a bill in the House. The Senate's a different matter,
right,
of course. Again, it gets back to what I was saying earlier. I think that Republicans, when these bills were finally being addressed, they were taking them up as we were going into this deep and horrible recession. I mean, this is really that was the fault of the leadership, of even putting them up there and having them considered for a vote as we were in this recession, after doing hard votes on the economic stimulus and on the bank rescue, and while they're working on health care reform. It just became apparent that was politically a bridge too far. And I don't think it had much less to do with Republican opposition than it had to do with the economic overhang that was going on at the time.
So that's the past. Future is California has AB 32, the landmark, now six-year-old law that Governor Schwarzenegger signed. That includes cap and trade. The California Chamber of Commerce initially opposed that, but did not oppose a ballot initiative to a referendum on that. So are you now supportive of where cap and trade is going in California, or are there changes you think ought to be made?
Well, cap and trade, the Air Resources Board has just adopted rules for cap and trade. They adopted that at the end of last year. And to coin a phrase, I think that's turned into regulatory mush. The cap and trade notion of a market for trading allowances for emissions has been turned upside down by the Air Resources Board and turned into a $20 or $30 or $40 billion tax on energy, which is completely unnecessary to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in California, and is threatening to undermine the entire program.
Though there's lots of popular support for that. Donnie Fowler, cap and trade, is it on the right track, or is it going to raise prices unnecessarily?
It's not going to raise prices unnecessarily. There's a story, as long as we're telling stories about brownies and other things, there's a story about cap and trade, or taking care of the external problems, the pollution that fossil fuels produce. You know, when you drive down the road in your car and you've gone to a fast food restaurant, you finish your burger and your soda, you throw it out the window, the policeman's going to pull you over and give you a fine. Coal companies and the oil companies that drive through our economy toss their pollution out the window, and they get no fine at all. There's no economic price that they pay for what they do to the larger society. Cap and trade is a market-based mechanism to try to put some limit on the amount of trash that oil and coal throw out the window, and to give a price or a penalty if they continue to do it. It also gives them a pathway through the market to reduce the amount of trash they throw out the window. Now, much of what Lauren said about the Republican criticism, conservative criticism of cap and trade is fair, I would say that's right, and there are some very big political reasons that conservatives want to stop cap and trade, or what they call cap and tax. One is they don't want to give President Obama or the Democrats a political victory. So there is politics in this. The other is that there's a tremendous amount of money, campaign money, in politics and in legislation. And the oil companies and the coal companies outspend the environmentalists and the alternative energy industry 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 to 1 or higher. This year, for example, 2012, the coal industry has announced a $40 million campaign to promote clean coal. Even the Bush administration said clean coal wasn't a technology we have today. The oil companies are spending $68 million more to promote their campaign for more drilling. The alternative energy industry and the environmentalists combined are unlikely to have something that approaches $20 million. So that's $108 million to about $20 million this year. That money is not only affecting the public perception, but it's influencing legislators, because a lot of that money is campaign money. So Lauren's right about the legislative mush and the regulatory mush that might come, and that's a fair argument, but it's not the whole story.
Dave Metz, does that money influence public opinion? Is there a way to track that in your polls, that that kind of onslaught of advertising, clean coal campaign, all those sorts of things?
Yes. Money in politics does influence what people think, but it doesn't necessarily lead people to believe exactly what the advertising wants them to believe. What it can do is it can take what would otherwise be an issue where the public is clearly on one side and muddy it up, cause them to be confused, cause it to sort of lose priority with the public. And that's the threat from what Donnie is describing. But at the same time, on the underlying premises of the policies we're talking about, public support has been very consistent. Despite money that has been spent over the years. If we look at the notion of AB 32, the field poll last year found that 60% of Californians support it. That was roughly the same proportion that voted against Proposition 23.
And we should be clarifying, Proposition 23 was a ballot proposition in California that wanted to basically suspend the cap and trade and the climate change law in California.
Okay. And what we've seen in the data is that despite the fact that we've been in a down economy for 4 years, despite the fact that the vote on Proposition 23 took place 2 years after the crash on Wall Street, that level of public support in the state has remained consistent. And there is a sense, and we saw this in the research that we did during the campaign, that the public is hesitant to move backwards. Having taken a step to address a problem that is not going to get better on its own and is not going to become less of a problem over time, the public is hesitant to move backwards. And so I think a lot of money can be spent against it, but the evidence so far is even when it is, there are still some underlying values there that are pretty strong and pretty durable. And it may take our political system a while to catch up to those public perceptions, but ultimately it will.
There is one exception of where you can see some impact, and that's among the most conservative voters in the United States. The debate over the Solyndra solar company and its failure has been pitched very hard by very conservative media like Fox News and AM talk radio. And if you look at some numbers, polling numbers, for the most conservative voters in 2011, you said traditional energy versus alternative energy. 47% said traditional energy, 43% said alternative energy in 2011. This year, 1 year later, it's about 65% that want of conservatives that want traditional energy, and only 26% now that want alternative energy. So a 4-point gap has turned into a 29-point gap with a limited number of American voters, and those tend to be the most conservative. So that money is, Dave Metz is actually absolutely right. The money has broadly not changed Americans' support for clean energy. But for a select number of very important conservative voters and activists, it has become a very, very telling story, you know, about politics. And it will is influenced Republican primary for president. Right. We're going to see whether it influences the general election.
And that's a very important distinction to draw. We've been generalizing about what Democrats think or about what Republicans think. on these issues, issues relating to energy and the environment, what we see is that among Democrats, between the most liberal Democrats and moderate and conservative Democrats, there is relatively little difference in their positions on these issues. Among Republicans, between those who support the Tea Party, those who are regular Fox News watchers, and those who identify themselves as conservative, when you look at that segment and compare it to more liberal and moderate Republicans who don't watch Fox News, who don't identify with the Tea Party, but think of themselves as Republicans, there are vast differences. That segment of the Republican Party on these issues looks a lot more like independents and looks a lot more, frankly, in some cases, like Democrats than they do like other Republicans. So you're talking about a relatively small slice of the American electorate that has very, very different perspectives on these issues. But it is that slice of the electorate that, as Donnie said, is what votes in Republican primaries.
Okay, so, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
But
Lauren K.
My answer to that is, so what? The Republican primaries are effectively over now. We have a de facto Republican nominee going into a general election, and you know, if that Republican nominee is half as smart as he's given credit for, he will put that. I can't come up with a good metaphor to go. He'll put that Republican base in his back pocket,
right,
and go after the great middle of American politics where elections are won and lost.
So what is not whether it affects the November election. It's if Mitt Romney gets elected. You've seen him. He published a book in the beginning of 2011 who said he believes in climate change. He believes it's man-made partly. And he believes that we should invest in alternative energy. Now, he doesn't really think climate change is necessarily happening. He surely doesn't think it's man-made. He questions the science. And he opposes alternative energy support. So that has had a real influence. And so if he becomes president, he's going to go in having staked that policy position. And whether he's held to that or not, Mitt Romney does have a little flexibility in his history. But whether he holds it, he has staked a policy position that may radically influence where we go with energy in this country.
That may be, Donnie, but I remember back in 2008, Barack Obama was foursquare against the individual mandate. I mean, things change.
Things do change.
Things change, yeah, and it's not just because likes an Etch-a-Sketch, another candidate likes a Slinky.
I mean, you asked so what, and my answer is so what is Gingrich was on the couch with Pelosi in 2008. He's now completely the opposite. Romney wrote in his book a year ago, he's now completely the opposite. So what? There's a so what here.
I don't want to minimize what you said about staking out a campaign position.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, if you look at Barack Obama in 2008 and you look at Mitt Romney in 2012, these guys have got to get through their primaries. And getting through primaries is one thing, and getting through the general and governing is a whole other thing.
Absolutely.
It is. And actually, the point I was making, it's fair enough about the presidential race, but I think that's an entirely different animal. Because of the level of scrutiny, the amount of attention that's devoted to it over a very long period of time by voters across the political spectrum, that kind of evolution is possible. I was speaking more about races in Congress, where the same primary process applies, but where every seat is different. And if you're in a Republican district and you win a Republican primary, you're fairly certain of being elected in November without having to change your opinions. When Barney Frank retired or announced his retirement, he said he was leaving the institution because he felt that it had reached a point where every Republican that he was working with either thought like Michelle Bachmann or was terrified of losing a primary to someone who thought like Michelle Bachmann. Now, the same thing is true among Democrats, right? This is the nature of the way our political system is structured, and it promotes the parties moving to the edges rather than coming to consensus. But I would argue that the divisions between conservative Republicans and more liberal and moderate Republicans on this suite of issues are much greater than the divisions among Democrats. And therefore, that polarization among Republicans has greater consequences within the institutions that have to make decisions about these policies.
And to Dave's point about the Republican Party nationally and Republican Party below that, there are many Republican governors, Michigan, Florida, and the Tea Party governor in Arizona, who are not as supportive as maybe a green environmentalist from San Francisco would like them to be of alternative energy. But those governors have taken some positions on policy that support the continued economic engine that is this clean energy, wind and solar. So it is very polarized at the national level in the national discussion. At the state level, we seem to have much more willingness to have a discussion about expanding the energy economy in this country.
I think Dave makes a fair point, and I think that's a very good point about governors. But I also think that you can't separate that. What you described as sort of a shift in public opinion on the far right or in the precincts in the right, I don't think you can separate that from the economic context, and that we're measuring these changes over time and during a time of economic crisis. And I think that if you look at any poll, I went back and looked at PPIC, Public Policy Institute of California polls, on issues that concern Californians over the last 4 or 5 years, and it supported what we all know, which is when times get tough, people care about the economy, and then after that they care about the economy, and then in third place is the economy, and then way down below is stuff like education and healthcare, and eventually maybe they'll think about the environment. When things get better, people are feeling more confident, those other issues come up, and that's the context that we're looking at that in. And so
here's two quick economic facts. One is that the fastest growing industry in the United States, according to LA Times very recently, is solar industry, also yoga studios and hot sauce. But the solar industry. Here's another economic fact. There are about 101,000 Americans who work in the solar industry. And there are about 107,000 Americans who work in the coal industry. So there are as many jobs now, and this has happened only in the last 3 or 4 years, in the solar industry as there is in the coal industry. So the economic argument is false. These are still small industries, but they are very fast growing, and they are creating real jobs, not just in Silicon Valley, but in Missouri and Ohio and Florida and Montana.
Yeah, the issue is not are there jobs in the clean energy industry? Of course there are.
Yeah.
It's been well documented. The question for voters is how much of a price do I want to pay out of my pockets in taxes and in foregone economic growth? You may not disagree with that, but that message, how much am I willing to put up with in order to support this industry? That's what the voters are questioning, not do I think there are jobs in the clean? Absolutely, grant that there are.
Lauren Kay is president of the California Foundation for Commerce and Education, affiliated with the California Chamber of Commerce. Other guests today at Climate One are Donnie Fowler, a Democratic clean tech strategist, and Dave Metz, a pollster with FM3. Dave Metz, you've done some polling asking Americans what they would pay for clean energy. But isn't it also true that what they will say to a pollster is different than what they would do with actually have to reach into their pocket?
Well, there's lots of reasons why it's difficult to figure out what people would be willing to pay for the kinds of policy changes we're talking about. Number one, they don't get asked to pay it directly. They don't go to the gas pump and say, okay, here's my share of money for oil exploration, for research and development, here's the oil company profits, here's the gas taxes, and here's the cap and trade share. It's all one lump sum. So it's not really a choice that's offered to them. And so we have to ask them realistically about the aggregate price, what they pay all in for energy and for the other commodities that are affected by these policies. And so if you ask people, if we implement something like cap and trade or other regulations or a carbon tax, will what you pay for gas go up? And they say, yes, absolutely. Do you like that? No. If we don't pass these policies, will what you pay for gas go up? Yes, absolutely. Do you like that? No. And when they start to think about the long term and the curve that we're on, their consciousness is we're not making any more fossil fuels. They're not getting cheaper. The techniques that we're developing to explore for them and try to extract more are more expensive, more time intensive, potentially more risky to air and water quality. And they're not ultimately in the long term going to make the commodity cheaper. On the other hand, renewable sources of energy in the long term are renewable. They are not going to run out. And there is a belief among the public that the cost curve over the long term is going to bend towards sources of renewable and clean energy. Now, they know that in the short term, you can't flip a switch. You can't simply change the source of electricity that powers your economy overnight and have that be a costless transaction. And they're not happy about the idea that they're going to have to pay more at some point in the process. But they know where they want to end up, and they know that they're going to be paying more somewhere along the way. And the more they think about that long term, the more the way they evaluate the costs begins to shift.
We're going to put a microphone out here and invite your participation. If you're on this side of the audience, we'd please ask you to go around through that door rather than crossing in front of this camera. We'll put it right there and invite you to come up with one part question or comment. If you need some help keeping it brief, I'll be happy to help. While you're doing that, I want to, this is often, don't be shy, come up there and join the conversation. High-speed rail is another example, big-ticket item. Californians supported it at one point. The economy goes south, the prices go north, and support softens. Is that fair to say, Dave Metz?
That's fair to say.
Lauren Kay?
Oh, it's indisputable.
So is it dead? High-speed rail?
Do I think it's dead? It is not dead. It has a lot of political support in Sacramento. The governor is a very strong supporter. The president of the Senate recently announced his support for getting the funds that they need. There's a little bit of money out there that legislature can spend on this, and the legislature likes nothing more than spending money, especially if they're not going to be around when the bill comes due in about 5 or 10 years. So I don't think it's dead today, but I wouldn't be investing in land in the Central Valley that you think is going to be covered by a railroad track. That's my advice.
But you do believe that there is broad consensus for infrastructure and jobs in the state and the country, just not this kind. What is the kind of infrastructure and investment the country ought to be making? If not high-speed rail, where should America be investing in infrastructure?
Oh, my goodness. Where do I start? In California, our ports are in desperate need for better infrastructure, including the roads and the railroads that tie them up. You know, our mass transit systems in our urban areas could use upgrades. Our highways are in terrible shape.
And should that be public money? System? Who should pay for that? Should it be a gas tax?
If it's public infrastructure, it's public money, and we should figure out a way to pay for it. Absolutely. I don't think there's much. There's not much controversy over the need. And over the benefit, you might quibble around the edges. How much should you spend on transit versus how much you should spend on highways? And you know, there'll be people who think that you ought to be able to do it for free. But I'd say there's a general consensus that we need to spend more on our public infrastructure.
The debate comes who pays and how. Mm-hmm. The head of the AFL-CIO and the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce were in Washington last year, proposed a 50-cent a gallon gasoline tax. That didn't last very long. But the idea was unions get jobs, business gets infrastructure, but someone has to pay for it. It's not going to be bonds. It should be consumers. Would that be something that the California Chamber would be interested in?
Well, I don't know about a 50-cent national gas tax, but yes, of course. There's a way to thread that needle. It'll have to be thread. It's probably not going to be in the next couple of years because we're going to be still recovering from a recession. We've got all sorts of state needs, especially the state budget. The voters are going to be asked this November about how they feel about raising income and sales taxes. My guess is they're going to be pretty grumpy about it. And if the voters turn down a statewide vote on a tax increase, it's going to be very hard to get a tax increase on anything else. And so this is a long-term issue, and something that I'm really glad you brought it up, because it's something that the public and the politicians need to spend more time worrying about than they are today. And I think high-speed rail is probably a distraction from that.
Dave Bennett?
Yeah, I mean, I would just agree with what Lauren said. I mean, it may seem like another eon ago, but it was 2006 when there was a package of infrastructure investments that was on the ballot here in California that had strong support from labor, from business, and was overwhelmingly approved by the voters. We are in a different era politically and economically, but ultimately the public's understanding that this infrastructure needs to be maintained and that they're the ones that ultimately will have to pay for it hasn't changed. And I do think I'm optimistic that when the economy improves, we'll be at a point where we can start having these conversations again.
There was another proposal, if 50 cents is too high, that's a huge jump. There was another proposal for a penny a month increase in the gasoline tax, and it had some bipartisan participants. Secretary Shultz, former Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, automakers, et cetera. The idea is that it's sort of so it's a drop every month, so it's hardly noticeable. Gasoline's going up and down so much. Who's going to notice a penny a month over 10 years? Is that the kind of thing that maybe there's some appetite for, or is it just any tax is not going to happen? Lauren Kay.
Oh, there'll be a time when we put more. When we put more tax money into transportation. I mean, there are ways of doing it, or into public infrastructure. It's more a matter of the economy recovering, and something that we've talked about earlier, which is the trust that people have or the lack of trust that people have in politicians spending their money. You know, the biggest impediment, frankly, to getting taxes increased or more spending on these issues is it's really, believe it or not, at least in my opinion, less the economy than just the abject incompetence and ineptitude that the people believe is inherent in the legislature and in the Congress. And you know, you really cannot expect people to part with more of their money voluntarily if they think it's going to be flushed down the same old sewer.
Donnie Fowler, is government a sewer?
The National Weather Service last week saved a lot of lives by predicting tornadoes in the middle of America. Americans wake up every day and drive on paved roads and used, which were, as we've noted, started by the federal government in the 1950s, where they take trains that are on rails that were built during the Civil War in the 1860s. So Americans often don't remember the things that the government has provided them every day until it's being taken away. But Lauren's right. There is a lack of faith in government by both conservatives and liberals and people in the middle. There may be different reasons. In the energy space, a lot of Americans believe that you can't change policy at the national level because big energy companies and their lobbyists control the system. So it's not that they don't want the government to send market signals or even to spend money on alternative energy. They don't believe it'll happen because the politicians are owned by lobbyists and old energy. So there is a lack of trust in government, but it's not just because it's government per se.
And Dave Metz, your polling suggests that Americans believe that corporations can solve the energy and climate issues more than government.
I don't know that I'd characterize it totally that way. I think what the polling shows is that the public believes that there is a role for both the public and private sector in making the kinds of large changes to our national infrastructure that we're talking about here. If the government were left on its own to determine how money was going to be spent and to develop the industries itself, it probably wouldn't succeed. On the other hand, if industry on its own, given the markets that are available today, were left to develop clean energy, it probably wouldn't happen on its own either. So it's going to take, as Donnie said, government that is playing a role, making some investments, sending some market signals, and that's something that the public is very comfortable with, the idea that there's incentives and the government is trying to nudge industry in one direction. It's going to take that, but it is also going to take industry doing its part as well.
Dave Metz is a pollster with FM3. We haven't talked a lot directly on climate change. I want to do that before we close here. The Pew organization did some polling and came up with six Americas, a spectrum of people and their positions on global warming or climate change, ranging from alarmed, concerned, cautious, disengaged, doubtful, and dismissive. 65% of Americans they found in 2011 were either alarmed, concerned, or cautious, and a third of Americans were disengaged, doubtful, or dismissive. Is that consistent with what you find in your polling?
It is.
And so let's peel that back a little bit. So does that coincide with the political spectrum? Are there Republicans who are alarmed and concerned? Are there Democrats who are doubtful, dismissive? I mean, does that spectrum also hold along partisan lines?
there is broad consensus among the American public on certain issues relating to climate. The vast majority of Americans believe that some kind of climate change is occurring. They disagree on whether it is primarily caused by human activities, and they disagree about what policy steps should be taken in the near term to address it. Most of those differences, to the extent that they exist, do fall along partisan lines. The biggest changes that we have seen in attitudes toward climate change and global warming have taken place in the last 5 or 6 years, and they have taken place almost entirely among Republicans. Democrats' level of concern about global warming has remained fairly constant for the last decade, and even independents, it's gone down a little bit. But since shortly after 2006, shortly after An Inconvenient Truth, support among Republicans has plummeted. Levels of concern about the issue, support for doing something about it. And again, that's an issue that we see a very, very strong correlation with where people get their news. If you are a Republican for whom Fox News is your primary source of information, you are going to be much more skeptical about climate change. Now, there's a chicken and egg issue here. Is it that people with that kind of skepticism gather together and are more likely to watch Fox News, or is it that the information that they're receiving drives them further in that direction? It's probably a little bit of both, but that's the main trend that we've seen.
But earlier, Lauren Kay, and I've read these reports myself, that say, well, when the economy gets bad, that people, the environment as a concern goes down, and concern about climate change goes down because there's other more primary concerns. Are you saying that's not the case, that the concern about public climate change doesn't wax and wane with the economy?
I would argue the data shows that among Democrats it doesn't. Overall, if you average together the opinions of all Americans, it has shifted over the course of the last 2 years. But that change has been driven largely by Republicans.
I think it's important to make a distinction, though. The issue of are you concerned about it is different from what would you do about it, and the concern about it doesn't have to have anything to do with the economy. Now, and maybe it does for some voters, but it doesn't have to. What you do about it, though, do you impose a regimen of cap and trade or a gas tax or a carbon tax or whatever it may be right now, or do you do it later, or could you have done it 5 years ago? Those are the questions that A, matter for public policy, and B, are influenced by the overall economic climate.
So is there, it's one thing to be concerned if it's cost-free, but if you're concerned and you have to do something about it, it's going to cost you, then that's going to have a different set of choices. Is it fair, Dave Metz?
It's fair, although I would argue that, frankly, on a lot of the major policy options, opinion hasn't changed a lot either. Gas taxes were not popular 10 years ago. Gas taxes are not popular today.
They never will be.
And as we've discussed here in California, AB 32 was, as a law in its broad strokes, was popular in 2006, and it remains popular today. Are there specific policy proposals where there is some difference? Yes, probably. But generally, I think we overstate the degree to which public opinion is swinging wildly. There is a fair amount of stability on these issues, differences within some subgroups and maybe on some very specific policy issues. But the broad strokes of opinion have remained fairly stable.
Recently, the New York Times reported that another public opinion poll is connecting extreme weather events with climate. And they're, in this case, actually out ahead of scientists. They're making a connection that scientists won't yet make. So the question is whether you think that some extreme events could actually change perception of climate change. Or do you measure that at all?
We do, and there's a distinction to be drawn between people believing that a changing climate will over time lead to more extreme weather events and believing that changing climate has led to one specific event on the ground at one time. And what we're seeing among the public is an increasing awareness that these extreme weather events are taking place, a sense, whether based on fact or just perception, that they are becoming more frequent and more severe. And there is an attribution in their minds, even among some who are skeptical about the causes of climate change, that there's a linkage between the two.
Certainly insurance companies know that it's happening, and they're very, very concerned about the cost that they're bearing. Before we close here, we haven't talked about fracking, which is in the news a lot. It's very much of an issue. It's a regulatory issue here in California. We have some hydraulic fracturing here in California for enhanced oil and gas recovery. Lauren Kay, do you think that's something that the public cares about? Should it be regulated more in California?
Fracking's been going on in California for decades and decades, and it's become an issue
in California because it's an issue back east, and folks who make it their business to regulate the energy industry in California want to get on that particular issue as well. You know, it's something the legislature is looking at, the regulators will look at, and if it's a problem, they'll deal with it. It hasn't been a problem for all the time that it's been practiced in California. It's different in California than in other states. In California, you frack for oil. In other states, you frack for gas. They're different geological structures. So it's a different situation. It's probably going to wind up with a little bit more regulation because that's what we do in California, but it's probably not going to make much difference.
Well, there's other states. Texas and other states have more disclosure rules than California has. What's in the cocktail of liquids that's mixed with the water? So actually, in fracking, California is not in the most regulated state. There's others that are have more onerous disclosure in terms of what's actually in the cocktail and exactly where they are, that sort of thing. But maybe that will come. Does the public care about fracking, Dave Metz?
Well, the first thing I'll tell you is they don't like the name. If you're going to come up with a name for a process, fracking is about the worst brand you could possibly...
Worse than cap and trade?
Well, and actually the alternative, hydraulic fracturing, is also... they have a negative reaction to. I would say here in California, the public has very low awareness of it. As Lauren said, it's something that's an issue in eastern states, and we've seen much more concern and awareness about it there. But it's an issue that hasn't become as ripe here in California as other places.
Last question. I heard Hunter Lovins, a author and a noted environmentalist, author of Natural Capitalism. She said at a conference this week that if Mitt Romney was elected president, he could do more on climate than President Obama in a Nixon to China kind of way. Yes or no, Donnie Fowler?
It's possible, especially with the opposition of the Republican Party to President Obama just on principle. So in that sense, Romney might be able to pull some of these Republicans, especially in the Senate. There's 6 or 8 or 10 Republican senators who don't want to stick their head up by themselves, and they're looking for someone to do it. So could Romney pull 6 or 8 or 10 Republican U.S. senators into some sort of clean energy policy in this country? The answer is he probably could, but it's very difficult to know who Romney is on this issue, because he has moved around and around largely because of this very difficult Republican presidential primary.
Lauren Kay?
You know, presidential elections in many ways are like Rorschach tests, because voters and interest groups and pundits can project their own vision on these candidates, because they are either a blank slate like Barack Obama was in 2008, or an etch-a-sketch like Mitt Romney. I'll deny I said that, by the way. like Mitt Romney is alleged to be in 2012. And so you can pretty much attribute your values and your policy preferences pretty comfortably there, and then build a theory around it. So anything's possible, of course.
Dave Metz, not really a polling question, but you know, is it possible that you know, the public might go along with something just because Romney's supporting it, leading it?
I think the factor that Donnie mentioned is the most important one, which is it's as a matter of being able to have an open and receptive audience in the Congress. That's an enormous advantage that Romney would begin with. And as we've discussed, there isn't overwhelming public opposition to some of these policies that has to be overcome. And if you have someone who's willing to show some leadership, who knows how to frame and communicate the issue in the right way, and has a partner in Congress that's willing to support it, sure, I think there could be opportunities.
As I heard a former Assistant Secretary of Energy in a Republican administration say this week, a lot of Republicans were for cap and trade until January 20th, 2009. We have to end it there. Thanks to our panelists today. Dave Metz is a pollster with FM3. Lauren Kay is president of the California Foundation for Commerce and Education, affiliated with the California Chamber of Commerce. And Donnie Fowler, a Democratic clean tech strategist. I'm Greg Dalton. Thank you all for coming to Climate One.
Thank you.